this, that the rain will stop tomorrow. The highest authority doing the weather forecasting people via comma. Secondly, walking meditation today in the rain. You're very welcome to walk in the rain if you want. You may have umbrellas and waterproof clothing. Otherwise, you can use the dining room for walking meditation. And also, I would suggest, if you like, you can walk in here, but being mindful of the fact that we have dedicated this room to those who wish to sit. So if other people are sitting in here during the walking period, be very careful that you're quiet and non-disturbing to their sitting. And of course you can walk in the corridors. We'll be using the staff room and the other room, so they have to be kept clear. But remember that walking meditation can be done actually on a very small area. I sometimes teach in a centre in New York, which is on the 10th story of a tall building, and a room about this big, there's sometimes 100 people in it. And people just walk just 2 or 3 steps backward and forward. So the fact that it's crowded is not actually a problem. Another point that Thomas has raised to me that I should perhaps say a few words about now. Some of you have expressed interest in the texts that I'm reading from, the titles of the suttas. Now, I plan to post all of this information on our website in the next few weeks. I could, if need be, write them all down on a piece of paper here, and you could copy them. If you really want that, I'll do so. But otherwise, if you could just wait 2 or 3 more weeks, you'll find a comprehensive list of references up on our website. We can talk more about that, though, at the end of the retreat. Anything else? That was it. That's www.stephenbatchelor.org. We'll also put all that information up. That we certainly will pin up. Our own website. Now, today I'd like to take the idea of dependent origination or contingency into its next phase, as it were. The day before yesterday, when we looked at the Buddha's awakening, we saw how he identifies this awakening with his understanding of the conditioned arising and passing of all things. In other words, an insight, a very deep insight, into, one might even say, the governing principle of the phenomenal world itself. Someone pinned a question on it saying, but when did he then come to understand the Four Noble Truths? Since this is often given as the object of his awakening. Rather flippantly, perhaps, I said that dependent arising was a bit like the E equals MC squared of Buddhism. And that principle then becomes translated into a form of life, into a kind of practice. And the first step in that translation is from dependent arising to the Four Noble Truths. This is very clearly stated by a man called Nagarjuna, as you might have heard the word, who was really the first person to articulate the Buddha's insight in his own voice. He didn't just write commentaries or organize lists of technical terms, but he actually envisioned an understanding of the Dharma in a somewhat distinctive manner. Nagarjuna is the one who brought to prominence the idea of emptiness. The Buddha speaks in the Pali canon very rarely of emptiness. He uses the word, and he sometimes talks of it as equivalent to no self. There's a very interesting passage actually in one of the Pali texts where he describes emptiness as the Mahapurusha Vihara, the dwelling of the great person, the dwelling of the great person, where the great person or the sage, the wise person lives. Emptiness, though, is one of these terms that I think has caused a lot of confusion. We sometimes think of emptiness as something that we will come to understand if we meditate long and hard enough, then one day we'll arrive at an understanding or an insight into emptiness. And emptiness is then sometimes presented as a kind of, again, a sort of an alternative to God or some kind of absolute reality. But this is very misleading. Nagarjuna understands emptiness not as a thing or a state or something that we come to understand, but he understands emptiness rather as a process of letting go. And there's a very famous verse in his key philosophical text. He says, "The Buddhas say that emptiness is letting go of opinions. Believers in emptiness are incurable." The Buddhas say that emptiness is letting go of opinions. Believers in emptiness are incurable. So emptiness is really not something you can believe in or have opinions about, or set up as your new privileged religious object. But rather, emptiness might be better translated as an emptying, a letting go, a releasing of certain fixed ideas and views about yourself, about the world, about reality. It's a dropping away. Dogen, the Zen master, says that his awakening was that of a dropping away of body and mind, a falling away, a letting go of something, rather than coming to some kind of mystical insight into a privileged truth. Nagarjuna also identifies emptiness with dependent arising itself. And this is very, I think, the key of his work. Emptiness is not anything other than the experience of things rising and passing away, dependent on conditions that generate it, and then other conditions will cause it to pass. Emptiness points, therefore, to the absence of any fixed essence or substance or thing that is separate from or different from or apart from dependent arising. We have the instinctive feeling very often that there's something within us that does not arise conditionally and dependently, but something that is kind of always there in the background, maybe the witness to all things, something that remains the same, and something that perhaps will survive death. The Buddha acknowledges that that is indeed how we feel, but his process of meditative awareness and investigation is very much challenging that deep feeling that we have, and eventually opening up a way of being in this world without having to believe or hold onto such an essential notion of me, or you, or them, or us, or the state, or whatever it might be. So for Nagarjuna, this emptying is very much what allows us to achieve a certain intimacy, a deep intimacy, with the contingent nature of all things. It's a dropping away of what blocks or prevents us from embracing the dependent arising and passing of the world. Nagarjuna also, in another passage in the same text, says those who experience dependent arising understand suffering, its origins, its cessation, and the path. In other words, he recognizes that what underpins, or what underlies the teaching of the Four Truths, which I'm going to go into today, what underlies that is this very same idea of dependent arising. So the Four Noble Truths are the next level of manifestation, if you wish, of the principle of dependent arising. The Four Truths, again, are connected to each other causally. Craving gives rise to suffering. The path is the condition that leads us to an insight in which we see through, or we let go of what causes that suffering. This will become clearer as we proceed this morning. So we have the Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree in this state of insight, or nirvana, this awakening. And what is quite curious is that the experience seems to have been surprising and perhaps rather shocking that he doesn't quite know what to do with it. It's not as though he has this extraordinary revelation and then says to himself, now I'll go off and start Buddhism, or now I'll go off and open a meditation center. He actually, as we saw yesterday, says to himself, people won't understand this. It'll be a real hassle to have to teach it. Eventually, though, he decides that at least some of his friends, those who'd been practicing asceticism with, would perhaps get what he was on about. And so he goes off to Benares, about 120 miles from Bodh Gaya. Would have taken him a couple of weeks by foot. And there he finds his former companions in the deer park at Sarnak. Some of you have probably been there. And it's when he meets these five friends that he starts the process of teaching. And the first sermon, or discourse, or sutta, is called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which means the discourse that sets in motion the wheel of Dhamma. In other words, the unfolding of these ideas that come from the experience of dependent arising, dependent origination. And the very first thing he says is that he has awoken to a middle path, a middle way, that does not lead to either the extreme of indulgence in sense pleasure, nor to the extreme of indulgence in self-mortification or asceticism. He's found a way of life. And this way of life is one, he says, that generates vision and awareness. It leads to tranquility, insight, awakening, and release. It has eight branches: true seeing, true thought, true speech, true action, true livelihood, true resolve or effort, true mindfulness, and true concentration. This is very much, I feel, what he is primarily concerned about. I would argue, in fact, that he's more concerned about living in this world in such a way, including all aspects of our life, from the way we see things, think about things, the way we communicate, the way we act, the way we earn our living, the way we meditate. All of those things together constitute his understanding of the path. He doesn't emphasize in his very first statement enlightenment or nirvana. And I think the reason for this, which should become clear as we go through these four truths, is that nirvana, or letting go, or insight into dependent origination, this is actually not the end or the goal of the path, but actually the place where the path begins. If we look at the Four Noble Truths, we can see already that this is the kind of map that he laid out. It starts with looking into the nature of suffering, that leading us to an understanding of what we do that somehow aggravates or intensifies or creates that suffering, which he calls craving or grasping. The third truth is that of cessation or nirvana, this emptying, this falling away of certain fixed ideas, certain emotional commitments that we have. And that then leads us to the fourth truth, which is the Eightfold Path. What I think is perhaps the most important thing to recognize about these four truths is the way in which he spoke of each truth as having its own particular practice related to it. In other words, he doesn't say, you have to understand the four truths, and then you'll be enlightened. But instead of that, he recognizes that each truth requires a particular stance or relationship. I'll explain this. The first truth, dukkha, is something he says we need to fully know, totally and deeply know. The second truth, grasping or craving, is something that we need to let go of. The third truth, cessation or the stopping of craving, is something we need to experience for ourselves. And the fourth truth, the path, is something that we have to create. Something literally we have to bring into being, to cultivate. Look, it's only when we look at these four truths in terms of those four actions do we see why he stated them in the order in which he did. In other words, suffering, craving, cessation, path. A lot of people are puzzled as to why did he put them in that order? Why didn't he put nirvana at the end, for example? Why didn't he start with grasping and craving, which seems to be the beginning of things? Why that sequence? I think the answer to that question lies in recognizing that it's the four actions, knowing, letting go, experiencing, creating, that are in that order. So let's look at those and see how what in fact the four truths are presenting is a process of stages, one leading to the next, that culminate or that end in the creation of a path, or what he calls the entering of the stream. It's quite curious actually how we saw already yesterday how he described his experience as patisotagami, as going against the stream. And then he describes his awakening as entering the stream. This is another example of how he'll use the same word and give it a very different meaning. What he says goes against the stream, and it's by going against the stream that we enter the stream. Now, of course, it's not the same stream. The stream against which he goes is the stream of Mara, the Mara Sota, which we'll look at tomorrow. The stream which he enters is that of the Eightfold Path. So let's go to the first truth and see how this whole process begins. The first truth is simply called dukkha. Not, as many books on Buddhism would have it, that life is suffering. That may be true. But the point is that that is not the phrase the Buddha uses. The Buddha simply says, there is dukkha. And he describes dukkha, and again I'm just reading from the first sermon. He says, this is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is painful, aging is painful, sickness is painful, death is painful. Encountering what is not dear is painful. Separation from what is dear is painful. Not getting what one wants is painful. And so you have, again, a somewhat counterintuitive move. In other words, I think this is perhaps the most counterintuitive thing the Buddha does. He just says, if you want to find happiness and well-being, then look into suffering. Fully know suffering. Instead of, as we normally do, sort of try and avoid it. And we see this, I think, very much in meditation. It's all very well if we're sitting here and, you know, the body has not got any pain or not much pain happening, we feel more or less at ease in our minds, then it's very easy to meditate. We just watch the breath and we kind of space out a bit and feel kind of nice. No one to hassle us, phone doesn't ring. But then suddenly something happens that we don't actually enjoy so much. We get a pain in the lower back, or we start being anxious about something, we start worrying about something. And how do we deal with that? And it's very important in this practice to notice how we habitually react to pain. And by habitually, I mean it's entirely natural. It's instinctive. Pain provokes the response, as Martin would have said last night, of aversion. We want to somehow not have that pain. We want to somehow avoid it or do something else. And very often, pain or uncomfortableness or anxiety provokes the mind to spin off into some other orbit, a fantasy or a daydream or a memory or a plan, anything but actually being with that experience as it is here and now. So the practice of mindfulness, the practice of awareness, when we see it in terms of the first noble truth, is the practice of acceptance, not resignation, but accepting and acknowledging that this is the way things are happening right now. This is what's going on. It's quite difficult to be sometimes with what is going on. Sometimes what is going on is something we really don't like, and so we run away. We go off into some other space. The Buddha seems to be saying the very opposite. He's saying dukkha is something we need to know fully. We need somehow to be able to face this aspect of our experience, this fundamental kind of malaise or discomfort or uncertainty or anxiety, or we might call it the basic unreliability of life. It's very difficult to find the right word in English to translate dukkha. Suffering is not bad, at least in terms of a certain subjective feeling, which we call painful or uncomfortable or unsatisfying. But you have to remember that the Buddha also used the word dukkha as a characteristic of all conditioned things. He said, sabba sankara dukkha. All conditioned things are dukkha. Now this what is a conditioned thing, but to say that it is suffering, I think leads us to a kind of animism. I don't think my what is suffering. I dropped it on the ground in Australia and broke its face. I don't believe it suffered any pain. So what does it mean to say that this is dukkha? My own sense is that dukkha here means something like undependable, unreliable. We cannot base our lives and the well-being that we deeply seek on conditioned things. They'll let us down. They'll fail to deliver the well-being that they promise. And I think the best example of this in our consumer society is the advertising industry. And although we might laugh at some of the silly commercials on television, those commercials are only shown not because the companies are charities or that want to teach us something about the nature of life, because they sell products. In other words, when you look at a jar of coffee or whatever it is, the advert or the commercial is very good, is very skillful at suggesting that if you had that brand of coffee, somehow your life would be qualitatively improved. It's not just that it would be a nice cup of coffee, it would be something a little bit more than that. And so much of consumerism is premised on a kind of seduction. If you have X, then you'll be happy. And I think we're all susceptible to this. I know that I am. And when I see the latest model of the new Apple computer, or whatever it is, I have the funny feeling that if I possessed that object, my life would be seriously well enhanced. Intellectually, I know that's not true, because I know the next year, when the new model comes out, the one I got this year would look like a piece of junk. But somehow, I'm convinced, emotionally, that the possession of such a thing, with its nice, soft, glowing, titanium surface, would make me terribly happy. And it might for about 48 hours. But this is the point, that things are dukkha because they don't deliver. In the end, they don't fulfill the expectations that we have of them. That's the problem. Not the objects themselves, but the expectations that we project onto them. So to fully know dukkha is not just about acknowledging moments of pain and anxiety, but it's also looking deeply into the very nature of human experience, to see that whatever comes our way, whatever we're attracted to, whatever we are seduced by, is not actually going to deliver the kind of happiness it seems to promise. So there's a kind of unreliability and undependability within the very nature of conditioned and impermanent things. When I studied this in the Tibetan tradition, the first noble truth of dukkha included the understanding of impermanence, of pain, and of selflessness, of anatta. To know dukkha is much more than just knowing pain. It's about knowing the impermanent, unreliable, impersonal nature of all things. So again, this is very much what we do in the practice of vipassana. Vipassana has as its object impermanence and dukkha and selflessness. It's looking deeply into these aspects of life. And it's by such looking, such observing, such attention, that we slowly come to another sort of relationship with experience. We're no longer, or we're less and less, do we become just a sort of reactive victim of things. Something pleasant happens and you grab at it. Something unpleasant happens, you try to push it away. Amoebas can do that. Single-celled organisms. It is a primary function of sentient life. We're drawn towards what promises pleasure, we react against what threatens us. And the Buddha, and I think really all spiritual traditions, are seeking to transcend that habit of reactivity. The Buddha is very explicit about it. We need to be able to do this, though. It's not enough just to have the theory, or to believe in the Four Noble Truths, but we need to take each truth as a kind of injunction, a kind of instruction, a command, perhaps. The Four Truths, therefore, are not four things that Buddhists believe, but rather they are four suggestions as to how to live and how to act and what to do. It's a doing rather than a believing. It's easy to believe, so difficult to somehow practice and to carry out these suggestions. Now, the deeper we go in meditation, but not just formal meditation, also the way we pay attention in daily life, the way we come more and more to emphasize an awareness of impermanence, an awareness of dukkha, an awareness of anatta, selflessness, the more we do that, the more these things become familiar. They somehow infuse our sense of ourselves, our sense of the world. I think it's useful sometimes to think of the practice of meditation in this room, or when we're walking, when we're on retreat, when we're in silence, as a kind of laboratory, a kind of a training camp, where we discipline ourselves, and sometimes it feels kind of boring and repetitive. But what we're doing is we're training ourselves to notice aspects of our experience that usually we ignore, or we overlook, or we dismiss. It's not trying to tell us something we don't already know. We all know that everything changes. That's no great revelation. We all know that when this is, that might arise, or when this arises, that will cease. We know that intellectually. The purpose of vipassana, or of satipatthana, of paying attention, of looking deeply, is to acknowledge those things far more than we normally do, such that it becomes kind of intuitive. It becomes a felt sense. Our consciousness as such slowly becomes impregnated with a sensibility, a sensitivity to the changing nature of things, to the painful nature of things. We open our minds, not just in the head, but in the heart, in the body, to these aspects of experience. And the more that this becomes somehow familiar and normative, we'd say, in other words, it becomes more and more the way we tend to relate to our lives, the more that happens, the more that we take away the foundations for grasping and craving. If we really recognize that something is impermanent, it's not going to fulfill us deeply, it's not really in any deep sense me or mine, then our relationship to it will begin to change. We will see it for what it is in those aspects, and in doing so, the grasping at it, the clinging to it, the instinctive rejection of it, will begin to die down, begin to fade away. And this is what leads us from the first truth to the second truth. This is the sequence. The second truth is technically called the origin. The Buddha just called it the origin of suffering. But the point is, in practical terms, he's talking of this deep-seated grasping or clinging or craving that operates only because we instinctively see the world in a certain way. We see the world as containing the possibility of permanent satisfaction, which will be mine. Once we unpack or somehow dissolve those perceptions of permanence and so forth, then craving and grasping will lose its raison d'être, its justification. So when the Buddha says that the second truth is something we let go of, we relinquish, he's not suggesting that this is some kind of willful act. It's not that we say to ourselves, let go, let go, let go. It doesn't work like that. We've probably all had the experience of going to, say, a meditation teacher in a state of some anxiety or worry or difficulty and asking for advice. And the teacher, with extraordinary compassion, will tell us, just let go. As though all we have to do is let go of that. As though all we have to do is just let go of it. But unfortunately, it doesn't work. We might feel a certain, let's say, a certain kind of attachment to something or worry about something. We can repeat, let go, as a mantra a million times, and it'll have no effect at all. So the interesting question is, how do you let go? How do you do it? And I think the answer to that lies in seeing how these four truths function as a continuum. How fully knowing dukkha organically and naturally will lead us to letting go or dropping away of certain graspings and clingings. The letting go of craving is the natural outcome of fully knowing dukkha. In other words, we don't have to do anything. We need to establish a radically different relationship with our experience of life by seeing it for what it is, for seeing that it's impermanent and so forth. In doing so, those habits of grasping and clinging and hating will start to fall away. And we may have noticed this in meditation. It's often the case when the mind settles down, let's say over 3 or 4 days on a retreat, you start to notice the fluid, contingent nature of each moment. But at the same time, we begin to relax with that. We don't get so pushed and pulled by our wanting and our not wanting. We can actually create a spaciousness of mind in which we can see those processes happening without identifying with them. They arise and pass away as well. Let go, we also are embarking on a process that will bring us more and more to a place where that craving and grasping ceases to have any kind of hold over us at all. It's important to recognize that these four truths are not four states or stages, but they are simply a way of conceptually speaking of a process of development or growth. In the same way that we can talk about a seed, we can talk about a sprout, we can talk about a flowering plant, and we can talk about finally a great big tree, if you want. that's quite meaningful to talk of the growth of a tree in terms of these four stages, but in reality, there is no dividing line between them. It's not as though at some point the seed stops being a seed and suddenly becomes a sprout. The seed blurs into the sprout. It's an unbroken, seamless continuity. But conceptually, we can break up into bits, but experientially, there are no divisions. There are no interruptions. There's no movement from phase one to phase two. It's all of a continuity. And the same with these four truths. They're describing a process, a continuity, that with which one phase naturally and organically grows into the next. That fully knowing dukkha grows into letting go of craving, just as a seed grows into a plant. It's as natural as that. And then the third truth, and again in terms of the action rather than the idea, experience for yourself cessation. That is the next phase that follows letting go of craving. The more that craving is let go of, the closer we come to a moment when it ceases to have any control over us at all. And this is called cessation. And technically, this is what is meant by the word nirvana. Nirvana doesn't refer to anything other than the stopping of greed and of hatred and of confusion. We saw this yesterday. The unconditioned, the deathless, the Buddha described simply as the absence or the falling away of greed and hatred and delusion. He's talking about a state of being, a way of being, that is possible for us to experience for ourselves. But to experience this requires these previous stages, as it were. The knowing of dukkha, the dropping away of craving, and until the craving stops. Now, in all of the traditions, the Theravada, the Tibetan tradition, the Zen tradition, there's a point of common agreement here that this initial experience of stopping will probably only last a very brief period of time. In one Tibetan text I read, it describes it as lasting for as long as it takes for 16 goats to cross a bridge. Now, I guess it depends on how big the goats are and how long the bridge is. But the point is that it's something that is a kind of opening. In Zen, they call it Satori. In the Tibetan tradition, they call it Tonglam, the path of vision. And it's a kind of almost miraculous, transformative moment. It's the key moment. It's the moment at which we know for ourselves that we can live in this world without being conditioned by greed and hatred, delusion, in other words, by grasping and craving. We don't have to live our lives that way. And this moment of stopping is the moment in which we actually know that is possible. We don't believe in it anymore. We know that it can be done. It might just last a few moments. It's a great mistake to think that once we've had that opening or that insight, that from then on we're completely free and enlightened. That's not the case. None of the traditions, the Buddha himself, would have ever suggested such a thing. The force of habit, the force of, in Buddhist classical language, the force of beginningless lifetime, is such that all of those forces will come back. You don't just magically get rid of them one day. They will resurface, but with a difference, because now you're not any longer convinced that these things have to be the way, or have to be what motivates you or causes you to act. You are free from their directives, or at least you know you can be free. Chances are you'll keep on repeating the same old mistakes, but there'll be a part of you that'll always know that I didn't have to do that. It was not necessary that I grasp at things. There's a space of mind which we might recover in meditation or in other activities in our life, in which we find this strange freedom, this freedom to create, this freedom to speak, this freedom to act, which is not coming from grasping, but is, as it were, a kind of spontaneity that is simply a response to the world as it presents itself, that is almost not something under our control, a kind of naturalness. And so this moment of stopping, of cessation, however short it might last, is the moment at which we then move into the fourth noble truth, and that is into the creation of a path. This is very explicit. The Buddha recognizes that the moment of cessation he calls the entering of the stream. And when he's asked, well, what is the stream? He says, the Eightfold Path. Again, you often have the impression in reading some popular books on Buddhism that the Eightfold Path is a kind of basic teaching for lay people to somehow get their lives together a bit and to become good Buddhists. But no, it's not. I mean, it can be that. But it's actually far more fundamental. It's far more central to the whole project the Buddha has. That's where we're heading. And it's the stopping of craving, even momentarily, that opens up that path. Remember that a path is actually nothing but an empty space. We think of a path, for example, across the hillside here, the one that goes down to the houses over there. And it seems as though it's something imposed on the landscape. It's something that stands out. We can see it. But in fact, the path is a clearing. It's a space, it's a gap between things that otherwise would get in our way. The path that runs across a green field is actually the place where the grass has been taken away. The path that runs through a forest is the place where the trees have either been removed or naturally a path has been formed between them. A path is a gap. A path is a space. A path is literally an emptiness. There's nothing there. There is simply the freedom to move without obstruction. Buddhism is very keen on things like the hindrances, the obstructions. But such a language implies the existence of something that is being obstructed or blocked. And greed, hatred, delusion, restlessness, lethargy, all of these things are forces that somehow block us. They prevent us from taking the next step on the path. When the power of these things falls away, the possibility of being in the world from another perspective altogether opens up. And that's the path. But the path is not something that miraculously lies there waiting for us to just have a walk along it. The path is something that each moment needs to be brought into being. We need to create that space within ourselves, within our societies, within our communities, within our relationships. Can we be with these things in a way that is open, present, responsive, curious, fascinated? And then can we proceed to deal with them and to live with them in a way that's not driven by attachment and hatred and fear and grasping? Curiously, in virtually all translations of this word, bring into being or create, works in English will say meditate. The path is something you have to meditate on. It's a course of mental development. But this misses very crucially the meaning of bhavana. There's a place in Tel Aviv called Bhavana House or Bhavana Society. Bhavana doesn't mean meditation. Although in most Buddhist traditions, that's what it's come to mean. The Tibetan translated it as dom, which just means, for most of them, meditation. The bhavana comes from the word bhava, which means being, which is rooted in bhur, which we can hear the word be in English. It's the same root. So rather than meditating on the path, we bring the path into being. And the path the Buddha describes, as I mentioned already, entails everything we do, not just our meditation, but how we communicate, how we think, how we act, all of those things. So I'll stop here, and tomorrow I'm going to look at what it is that actually makes it so difficult sometimes to pursue this path. And that is found in the idea of Mara, or the devil. Thank you very much. And we'll now walk. I don't think it's actually raining. And meet back here at 11:45.